And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Blunt, our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program on the basics of the Medicaid program. Now, Medicare may be the largest federal health program in terms of dollars spent, but if you count the number of people enrolled in a given year, Medicaid's a lot bigger. More than 60 million Americans get Medicaid services in any given year. And there's a lot of money. There is a lot of money involved, more than $400 billion in combined federal and state spending in 2011. This is intended to be a basic education on this very complicated program, and I suspect that we're not going to cover all of the aspects of this program in even our very distinguished panel's presentations. And I can infer something like that from the primer that our friends at the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured have put together. And the primer is 47 pages long. There'll be a quiz on it at the end. But there are two big picture facts about this program that I want to emphasize as we get into this discussion. The first is that it's multifaceted. Medicaid covers kids and moms. It covers people with disabilities. It covers people needing long-term services and supports. It even fills in the gaps in the Medicare program for 9 million beneficiaries. And second, it's about to get a lot bigger and more important as a result of some of the changes put in place by the Affordable Care Act. So you can see why it's important to understand what Medicaid looks like now, what it does, who it serves, and how it's going to change, hence our primer today. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, is a major initiative of the Kaiser Family Foundation. If you've done any research on Medicaid, you've probably used the analyses generated by the commission. You're going to hear from its director, Barbara Lyons, in a moment. I just should note that early in the first session of each new Congress in recent years, the Alliance and Kaiser team up to hold a series of primers like this one on some of the larger health policy topics. For those of you who are new to the issues or new to Congress or have it as a new assignment in whatever your job is, we've jointly hosted a primer on Medicare a couple weeks ago. And in the coming weeks, we'll be doing one on the Affordable Care Act itself and another on healthcare costs in general. So thanks to the Commission and to Kaiser, Drew Altman, Diane Rowland, and their colleagues for their active involvement in this important work. And that's not a very subtle segue into turning to Barbara Lyons, who's a senior vice president at the foundation and director of the commission, who will be co-moderating today's discussion. Barbara?
Thank you, Ed, and welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to participate in this Alliance 101 briefing on the Medicaid program. As Ed said, Medicaid is big. It's an integral and dynamic part of our nation's healthcare system. Since its enactment along with Medicare back in 1965, the program has evolved considerably, both as Congress has expanded the program on numerous occasions, most notably in 2010 with the ACA Medicaid expansion, but also as states have turned to Medicaid to, as Ed said, address the health and long-term care needs of their citizens. And today, Medicaid does provide vital assistance to millions of Americans, as Ed noted, from infants and children to seniors and people with disabilities. That said, millions of poor uninsured, mainly adults, remain outside its reach. The ACA Medicaid expansion has the potential to address some of these gaps in coverage, and we'll see what states decide to do and accomplish over the next year. But state Medicaid programs are also very focused on, once you have coverage, what does that mean in terms of care delivery? With support from the federal government, states have been very focused on adopting new models of care delivery and innovations to improve the quality of the services that people actually receive and the efficiency with which those services are provided. And I know we're going to talk about that a lot today. Ed gave a nice shout out to our Medicaid primer, authored by Julia Paradise on our staff. Despite its 47 pages, it's a good read and a tremendous resource. So I encourage you to take a look at it. And we do have quite a number of resources up here on the panel today. So with that, let me turn it back to Ed, and we will be able to dive in. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Barbara. A little bit of housekeeping. You have materials in front of you. Those materials are also online at our website, allhealth.org. By Monday, I'm not sure when on Monday, you'll be able to watch a webcast of this briefing. As a matter of fact, through the good auspices of our colleagues at the Kaiser Family Foundation at their website, kff.org. You can also get there through ours. In a few days, there'll be a transcript of the briefing available on our website. And at the appropriate time, you can ask our panel a question. The green cards that you have in your packets will allow you to do that by writing it down. There are microphones that you can use to ask it orally. And there's a blue evaluation form that we would plead with you to fill out before you leave to help us improve these programs as we go. One thing about the questions, once we get to them, this is a primer. You should not be embarrassed about asking the most simplistic question, because we know that you often are crammed with a number of assignments, and maybe healthcare is only one part of your portfolio. We want to get you started. So no question too simple, and frankly, we have the experts up here at a level of sophistication that I'm safe to say no question too complicated that you won't get a really good answer.
Ed,
sir.
Barbara and I are worried that you're setting us up, because when we don't know the answers, what will happen? We'll be embarrassed.
Well, that's part of what we're doing here, Bill. I think mutually among the four panelists, you won't be able to stump the band, but we'll see. We're going to start with Robin Rudowitz, who's an associate director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. She's been with the commission since 2004, held a variety of positions before that at CBO, Lewin Group, CMS, and we've asked Robin today to give an sort of the opening lecture in the primer, in the 101 course, to outline the overall shape of the program, and of course, to do it within 8 minutes. No problem. Oh, Robin?
I'm going to try to beat the clock. Thank you so much, Ed and Barbara, and I'm excited to talk about this really important, complicated program, especially now because it is such a historic time in the program's history. And as Ed said, in a very short amount of time, I am going to cover the 47-page primer and really try to highlight 5 key points that I'll go over in terms of Medicaid, the roles it plays, how the money and spending is distributed, who's eligible for the program, how the program is financed, and then turn to the ACA. So this really first slide really echoes what Ed just said about the program. It really has multiple roles in the healthcare system. It's a program that provides coverage. It provides critical assistance to low-income Medicare beneficiaries. It is the primary payer and provider of long-term care services in the country, both institutional as well as community-based. Medicaid represents $1 in $6 spent in the healthcare system. And it also provides really important matching funds for states to work with to provide coverage to their residents. So that was the first key point. The second key point looks at spending and how the money is really distributed across the program. And I don't think I've ever really done a Medicaid presentation without this key slide. And it really just shows that the enrollees in the program are primarily made up of children and their parents, so about 3/4 of the enrollees are part of that group. But the spending is really concentrated with those who are elderly, blind, and disabled, and that represents about two-thirds of the spending on the program. These individuals have much more complex healthcare needs, and they use more acute and long-term care services. And another cut on that point is looking at those who are dually eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. We know that these individuals represent only about 15% of the enrollees on the Medicaid program, but they make up about 40% of the cost of the program, paying for services that Medicare doesn't typically cover, primarily long-term care. So the third key point I want to hit on is who is eligible for this program. I think there's a misconception that if you're poor, you're eligible for coverage, but really prior to the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid coverage was really for certain groups of people, and there's really broad coverage through the Medicaid program for children and pregnant women, and much more limited coverage for parents and adults. Right now, the median eligibility level for parents in the country is about 61%. Two-thirds of states cover parents at incomes lower than 100% of the federal poverty level. And again, prior to the Affordable Care Act, there was no pathway for adults without dependent children to gain access to the program. This is all really important because coverage matters, and there's lots of research that shows that Medicaid provides access to care that's really comparable to private insurance, and much better access to care and services than those who are uninsured. And when you look at both adults and children, you see that those who have Medicaid coverage really have much better access to a usual source of care, as well as access to getting the care that they need. So the fourth key point is really about financing. So Medicaid program is really financed jointly by the states and the federal government. There's a complicated formula based on states' per capita income, so poorer states have a higher federal contribution than those states that have higher per capita income. When you look at the total federal budget, Medicaid represents about 7 or 8% of total federal outlays. But when you look at state budgets, it's a little bit more of a complicated picture. And we see that Medicaid is really both a budget item as well as a revenue source for states. So when you look at total state spending on the Medicaid program, it is fairly comparable to what states spend on their education programs. When you look at what states spend of their own or their general fund dollars, you see that Medicaid is a far second to what states generally spend on education. And Medicaid, it's important to understand, represents the largest source of federal revenues that are coming into the states. So we often hear about Medicaid's role in state budgets, and it's not just an expenditure item, but it is also a revenue source. Another key piece of the financing is that Medicaid is a counter-cyclical program. So what that means is that during economic downturns, you see higher unemployment, lower incomes, and that means more people are eligible for the program. And eligibility is the primary driver of Medicaid spending. So if you look at this chart, it really shows this point very clearly, that during these economic downturns, like in the beginning of the decade, there's an increase in both enrollment and spending growth, and then we saw that happen again during this last recession. We also see that as the economy has been slowly improving, in 2012, we saw pretty record low rates of growth in both enrollment and spending, and we just put out a mid-year report of where states are in 2013, and it looks like they're pretty on track for continued low spending and enrollment growth in 2013. We also know that over the decades, states, as Barbara talked about, it's a dynamic program. States have really been working to control costs. Every year, states are implementing multiple actions to look at ways to better control costs in the program. These have run across a number of ways, provider payments, looking at benefits, and so there have been really a focus on these cost containment efforts over the last decade. There's also been a really important focus, and this effort has really intensified in the last few years, where states are really looking at implementing delivery system reforms and payment reforms, as well as initiatives focused on these very expensive and high-need populations, the duals in particular. So we are going to continue to watch what happens with some of these really important developments that states are working on. So the last key issue, of course, is the ACA. So Medicaid is a key element of the ACA. It really provides the foundation of coverage for low-income individuals as part of the health reform law. And this really shows that the Medicaid umbrella is really expanded to cover and expand coverage to those who have been typically excluded from the program and will expand largely coverage to adults on the program. In addition to expanding coverage, the ACA really does a lot to simplify and streamline the enrollment process. So there are provisions to encourage multiple ways to enroll in coverage in person, on the phone, online, by mail, et cetera. There will be a single application for health coverage for, that covers multiple programs, much more increased use of electronic data matching, and hopefully moving towards real-time eligibility determinations. And we know that nearly every state is really moving forward with advancing these new efforts, regardless, they're a requirement regardless of whether a state moves forward with the coverage expansion. I love this new chart that we have because it boils down a very complicated report that we did down to one simple slide. And it really looks at what are the effects of the ACA Medicaid expansion. And what we see is that the federal government really bears the cost, the large amount of the cost of the expansion. That's primarily because those who are newly eligible for coverage are matched at 100% of the federal government will pay 100% of the cost. It means a lot of increased coverage. So 21.3 million more people will be covered by the Medicaid program if all states move forward with the expansion, and that would mean, along with all the other provisions in the ACA, a reduction in the uninsured by about half. It also means some other savings for states, including reductions potentially in uncompensated care costs or shifting other money that states spend on other indigent programs, as well as additional revenue for providers and increased economic activity. I think in the end, what really matters is what the ACA does for people. We just did a report, and based on a bunch of focus groups, that really shows that obtaining Medicaid coverage really enables individuals to access care for the healthcare needs that they have, to access preventive care, and it really improves not just their health, but their whole interaction, their ability to work, their interactions with their family. And I think relief is the main word that individuals had used to describe that coverage. My time is beeping, but I am on my last slide. So I think looking forward into this year, there are lots of things that we're going to be watching around the Affordable Care Act, how states are moving forward with coverage, as well as eligibility simplification, the delivery system reforms that we talked about, as well as what happens and continues to happen with state and federal fiscal issues. I did have, will the automatic federal spending cuts go into effect? And I think we can answer that today, that yes, it does look like they will go into effect.
Okay. Can I get the clicker from you? Thanks very much, Robin. That sets the stage very well for the rest of the discussion. I should note that you can see on the bottom of the screen the hashtag if you want to join the Twitter universe and tell everybody about the fascinating conversation you're listening to. So, and the next part of that conversation is from the federal side of that federal-state partnership that Robin was describing, in the person of Barbara Coulter Edwards, who directs the Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group within the Center on Medicaid within CMS. But in her previous visits to our dais, Barbara has been on the other side of the curtain, most prominently as Ohio's Medicaid director for 7 or 8 years. It's hard to name a lot of people who know more about Medicaid than she does, and today she's going to share with us a look at what CMS is working on with respect to this program, including the preparations for the major changes that both Barbara and Robin alluded to as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Barbara, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. As Bill was indicating, we're all a little nervous these days to say anybody knows everything about Medicaid anymore because it is changing pretty dramatically as a result of the Affordable Care Act and as a result of state action around this program as well. And that's part of the excitement these days. So I'm happy to talk to you from a federal perspective at this point. Medicaid is the most important thing for you to know about it. It is a federal-state partnership. For those that are really comfortable in the Medicare world, that's sometimes the hardest thing to get your head around, is that there are these states and the district and the territories, and they all play a very key role in the program. There is a federal law, significant volume of federal regulations that create the frame for the Medicaid program. States within that have considerable flexibility to design the program they offer at the state level, and they are responsible for administering the program at the state level. And as Robin pointed out, sharing in the financing of that program with the federal government. So this is, in fact, both the strength of Medicaid and sometimes the challenge of it, is that if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program, because it really many programs serving many different roles at the state level. And it really is, I think, what has been the strength of Medicaid and why it became a foundation for expansion for universal coverage in the Affordable Care Act. Our goal these days is to be partnering with states, moving Medicaid from being a safety net program into a full partner in the larger healthcare delivery system, pursuing goals of better health and better care and lower costs so that we have a sustainable system nationally for all of us, whether in a public system or a private system. Within Medicaid, we have two major areas of focus at the federal level these days, and I want to just highlight those for you today. The first is, as Robin points out, the response to the Affordable Care Act and the role that Medicaid plays in the movement toward universal coverage in this country is that Medicaid is expanding. But what is really exciting, in addition to the number of people that will become eligible and be able to count on Medicaid to provide benefits, are some of the changes that are taking place in the way eligibility works in Medicaid. The goals for Medicaid include simplification of that process, modernization of the experience of working, of being covered by the Medicaid program, of getting that benefit package, and better coordination with the commercial marketplace. Medicaid is going to be moving in a place now where it's going to be much more closely aligned with what's going on in the commercial market, and it, particularly in light of the collaboration and coordination that needs to take place with state exchanges and the federal exchange in, on the private side. So there's a lot of change taking place as a result of this. And in addition to the changes to eligibility, as Robin said, more reliance on electronic systems, online, telephone, a Zappos experience, if I'm allowed to say that, my favorite shoe store. We're really trying to find a more modern experience for people and that there will be a single front door into affordable health coverage, whether it's in the private market or in the public marketplace. So that's important. As we move forward on that, we are also looking at a new definition of a minimum benefit package, at least for those who are newly eligible for the Medicaid program, those covered under the new adult eligibility group. And that is the essential health benefits that have been defined under the Affordable Care Act and through regulation for both the commercial market for qualified health plans and for the benefits for those who are newly eligible for Medicaid. So there is, again, this closer alignment in Medicaid with the commercial marketplace, as well as our traditional responsibility for serving those who are particularly vulnerable and high cost in health care. And all of that is, in fact, changing Medicaid, in, I think, toward the future in a way that we are still experiencing. The goal is that Medicaid and the exchanges and the subsidies, both through public insurance and in the exchanges, will lead to a market in which people are fully covered, either through Medicaid or, if low-income children, through CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or through the exchange. And this is, in fact, the goal that we are all pursuing in collaboration with the SOCIO folks in terms of the development of the federal and state exchanges. The second major reform that Medicaid is pursuing at the federal level really has to do with its role as a player in the larger healthcare delivery system, and that is the larger issue of health system reform itself, toward better care, better health, and lower cost over time in the healthcare delivery system. Some of the major focuses in Medicaid at the federal level, in cooperation with states, again, this is a federal-state partnership, which means nothing happens unless states, in fact, are the pick this up and implement these activities through their programs. But the areas of focus that we are paying attention to at the federal level are payment reform, trying to provide additional opportunities for states at the state level to shape the way that healthcare delivery operates and the outcomes that are achieved through healthcare interactions, through capitation payments, shared savings opportunities, new kinds of integrated care models. Those have become important issues for states, and we're working to try to make those more accessible in Medicaid. Quality measurement and improvement. There's a lot of attention in the Affordable Care Act and through the CHIPRA legislation for adult core quality measures and children's health care core quality measures. There are additional activities being financed under the Affordable Care Act and embraced enthusiastically toward developing better measures of care and quality so that we can increasingly see systems move away from paying for transactions in health care and beginning to pay more for the outcomes that we're all seeking in terms of good health care. Integrated person-centered care is a high priority for the Medicaid program. We are encouraging states in their interest in finding better integration both of primary, acute, and long-term care services around an individual's needs. Physical health care and behavioral health care integration is a high focus. Medicare and Medicaid being integrated as payers is an important focus of the program. And always with the long-term services and supports that Medicaid provides, an important focus on integration of individuals into the community, those particularly who are living with chronic and disabling conditions. One of the major focuses that we have picked up in the last few years has been paying more attention to the role that Medicaid plays in behavioral health care, mental health, and substance use disorders. It's an important issue in terms of the expansion populations that will be coming into the Medicaid program, but also critical to the larger goals we have for good health care in this country. And we are paying a lot of attention to benefit design, to improved access for children, as well as issues of how we can better finance the right kinds of services through the state programs. And finally, but never last for us, is continued transformation of our long-term care services and systems so that people can receive those services in the settings that they prefer, be fully integrated into the community if that's what they prefer and is appropriate for them. Medicaid has been a real leader on this. States have been real leaders on this. And we continue to see a great deal of attention paid to this. The Affordable Care Act, in fact, gave us enormously important new tools at the state level through the Balancing Incentive Program to support continued transformation, through extension and enhancement of the Money Follows the Person grant program that allows states to fund activities and services to help people leave institutional settings and move back into the community, and through other services like health homes and other financing opportunities that encourage better integration of services at the community level that includes physical, long-term care, and behavioral health care services that wrap around the needs of the individual. So there's a lot of really active, a lot of activity at the state level. You'll probably hear about that some from the state leaders here. But it's a time of great change and great excitement, and we have a lot of anticipation of the improvements that are coming. I've got a couple of website references here for people that want more information on what's being made available for states, how states are leading in this effort to move Medicaid forward into a modern healthcare delivery system. And I encourage you to check us out at Medicaid.gov. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Barbara. As Barbara said, when you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program. We have two exemplary Medicaid programs to have you examine at some depth with the help of the people who oversee those programs. So from the other side of this partnership, two current state officials, I'll introduce them both at the same time so not to disturb the flow. We'll hear first from Charles Milligan, who's the Medicaid director in Maryland, and then from William Hazel, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Resources in Virginia. Actually, Chuck's duties are broader than just Medicaid. His formal title and responsibilities are as Deputy Secretary for Healthcare Financing in the Maryland Department of Health. Dr. Hazel is he's an orthopedic surgeon on the side, but his department spans not just Medicaid and CHIP, but also behavioral health, social services, aging and disability, in all about a third of the Commonwealth's budget. So we're going to hear first from Chuck Milligan. Thanks for being with us, Chuck.
Thank you very much. I want to sort of jump on a couple things before slides, and I'll do the slides really quickly. I just want to contextualize it a little bit differently in terms of big picture and picking up on some of what Ed and Robin said. Big picture, there's about 60 million people on Medicaid right now, so 1 in 5 in the country, plus or minus, 1 in 5 in the country. Roughly speaking, Medicaid and CHIP are covering about 1 in 3 kids in the country. Roughly speaking, covering about 1 out of 4 deliveries. Roughly speaking, picking up about 2/3 of the people in nursing homes. Just some context. Depending on how many states pick up the Medicaid expansion, we could go up to about 1 in 4 people in the country on Medicaid. With respect to dual eligibles, those people on both Medicare and Medicaid, there's 9 million or so in the country. Ed mentioned that figure. These are people who are the most expensive people to Medicaid because they often are using nursing homes and long-term care. Many of them are poor seniors, although there are a lot of people who are younger, under age 65 with disabilities. But they're the most expensive population to Medicaid. They're also the most expensive population to Medicare because these are people who, for a variety of reasons, are also on Medicaid based on poverty or mental illness or comorbidity. And they use more hospital services and other services in Medicare. Just to give you a couple of other data points about dual eligibles, Ed mentioned that Medicaid's the biggest program of the two nationally in terms of enrollment. Medicaid's bigger than Medicare. Medicaid is also more expensive than Medicare overall, not to the federal budget, but in total budget, counting the state funds. And for dual eligibles, Medicaid spends more than Medicare on those dual eligibles. So these people use hospital a lot, they use physician services a lot, they use Part D drugs a lot, but the amount that they use in Medicaid services like long-term care, plus the fact that Medicaid is picking up all of their out-of-pocket in Medicare, like in Maryland, we're spending about $250 a month for dual eligibles just in their copayments and deductibles in Medicare and premiums, Part B premiums. So just some data points. I want to go through the slides kind of quickly. Maryland is a state that's doing the Medicaid expansion. I'm just going to sort of highlight some of the things that that entails. But again, I'm going to just sort of tee this up and see if you all want to play Stump the Band later. In terms of the eligibility system, we're building the system that Barb referenced. So this is a brand new eligibility system, brand new eligibility rules coming out of the ACA, modified adjusted gross income. We're going to be linking to the federal data hub that the SSIO is putting together that has data from the IRS, Homeland Security, Social Security, and others. We've actually been actively testing our eligibility system at the state level with SSIO system. It requires a lot of work, and we're working very hard at it. I'm coming from a meeting this morning to do it. And it's not going to be just for those people who are part of the expansion population, but a lot of the current Medicaid eligibility groups, like the family and children and poverty groups, are going to go into this new set of rules, how income and all of that is calculated, modified adjusted gross income. So we've got about 800,000 people in Maryland who are in our program today, but come 2014, their determinations will be made based on a new set of income rules. By the way, this is really good, not just because it's seamless then with higher income premium tax credits and the exchange and all of that, but also because the rules in Maryland will be the same. MAGI is a national set of rules. We're going to be the same as Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, D.C., all of our adjacent states. So as people move back and forth, they're going to be at the same level for MAGI, and it's not going to be very state-specific income and disregard stuff. A lot of work. We're building an expanded workforce to get people enrolled. This includes navigators that are part of the ACA. It includes shoring up our local health departments where a lot of eligibility for pregnant women and some poverty children come in. It includes shoring up our local welfare offices, our field offices, because a lot of these families, let us not forget, are going to continue to qualify for SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is set roughly at about 133% of poverty. And so they're going to want to get all of the benefits to which they're entitled, including SNAP. So we're working on all of the eligibility workforce capacity building. We're working on building capacity in our delivery system, that is to say the healthcare provider side of things. We did raise our rates for primary care by about 25% January 1st. A lot of this was in the ACA in terms of raising rates for primary care providers for 2 years with enhanced federal funding. Maryland chose to raise these rates for specialists, too, who do primary care visits. So all of what people refer to as evaluation and management codes, these are really when you see a primary care, for a primary care visit to, you know, a checkup kind of stuff. We raised those rates, and we're actually now going to be paying higher than our biggest commercial insurance company in Maryland, our version of Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is known as CareFirst. And we're doing other delivery system reforms about all-payer patient-centered medical homes and other kinds of things to build out workforce in our delivery system to anticipate all of these new people who have an insurance card and expect to be seen. Part of building delivery system capacity means working with a lot of sort of safety net providers, and we've kind of organized it into two groups of providers. There's a whole bunch of providers out there that really don't have a lot of experience submitting claims to insurance companies, including Medicaid. They get grants, and that is to say they get state or local pots of money, sometimes from HRSA federally, but sometimes from state and local sources, and they don't know how to submit claims. It's never been part of their mission. So it might be school-based health centers. It might be free clinics. It might be some addiction treatment providers. It might be others. So as more of their population gets insurance and the number of uninsured people goes down, the need to keep giving grants goes down. We shouldn't be funding as if it's still a huge uninsured population going into these free clinics if those people have insurance cards. And so part of what we're doing at a readiness level is teaching these providers how to submit claims, how to get contracts, how to get credentialed, quality measures, HEDIS scores, all that kind of stuff. Then we've got another group of providers that know how to submit claims. They're part of the insurance world, but they really focus really primarily on Medicaid. They work in our world, but they really don't work in the commercial world. And so if they want to follow their patient who's moving back and forth as their income changes, they've got to figure out how to get contracts with Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna or United Healthcare or others. So we're working with that group of providers like FQHCs and community health centers and urban Indian providers and providers like that that have really been very much part of the public payer system, not so much part of the commercial system. And one area I want to highlight in kind of picking up on Barb's point about behavioral health, we have a very robust public mental health system that serves a lot of people in Medicaid with severe and persistent mental illness, various serious addiction issues. Given parity and given the social health benefits in the exchanges, the commercial carriers really need to build out their networks for behavioral health, and they do not have adequate networks to deliver essential health benefits to the extent of the ACA. And so they need those providers who have been playing in the public world, but those providers don't really have a clue how to deal with prior authorization and utilization review and all of that stuff. So we're working on that. We're adding new managed care organizations. We have a very robust capitated system. We're bringing on 3 new MCOs this year, including Kaiser Permanente, which is exciting to us because then Kaiser's going to bring all of their physicians who have not been part of Medicaid before. And there's other MCO and insurance carrier activity as Medicaid MCOs want to get into the commercial world and vice versa so that they can follow their patients across sort of programs and products. And finally, we're working on continuity of care. It's one thing for somebody's insurance card to be seamless, like, okay, I was Medicaid yesterday, but now my income went up and I'm in the exchange today. But if I have a disruption in my care, that's a problem. And so there's pending legislation in Maryland's General Assembly that would protect it, continuity of care in 2 areas. First, if I've in the middle of a course of treatment with a prior authorization, like I'm halfway through physical therapy or a series of mental health visits, and then I change into a new program, that receiving insurance company will honor and allow me to complete that course, even if that provider is out of network, so that I can finish what I started. And secondly, that if I got an authorization, for example, that I need surgery, that that authorization will be honored, and I'm not going to have to go back through the PCP and back through a specialist and say, okay, yeah, the surgery is medically necessary. So that legislation is pending in Maryland. So we're working on those dimensions. I will stop there. I look forward to your questions.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. Let's turn to Bill Hazel.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed. And our Medicaid director is Cindy Jones, and she's at a meeting today, so she sent her secretary. So I do not have the same subject matter expertise that some of my colleagues do here, but I will do my best. It's tempting to not use my slides and just do a little bit of response, but I'll try to do a little of both. But I think Ed had originally asked me to be here representing a state that is not expanding. And I'd like to take a poll of the audience. Who here read in the paper that Virginia's expanding Medicaid? Okay, raise your hands. I can't see. Okay. Who here read that Virginia's not expanding Medicaid? Okay, now you know what I'm trying to figure out. What Chuck has told you fundamentally about the Medicaid program and what we are doing is identical in Virginia. I can tell you eligibility systems, workforce, the provider capacity, and so forth. So don't need to go through that with you. But what I do think it's important is to reiterate that states are different. And separated as we are by the Chesapeake Bay and the Potomac Ocean, we have a very different culture in Virginia. And on the day that the sequester begins officially, I must remind you there is no free money, that the taxpayers, be they federal or state, are the same people, which is one of the ironies. The most interesting piece is that state legislators do not like to raise taxes to pay for somebody else's promises. That's a challenge. Second thing I'd like to say is that the real challenge, we believe, in Virginia is the cost of health care. And we spend 18% of GDP. Everyone in this room has probably heard that, 18% of GDP spent on health care in the United States. So what? As an orthopedic surgeon, that's great. Bring it on. I mean, 20-25% is exactly what we need, more spent on health care. But let's put that in the reality of the global food chain. What country is second as percent of GDP spent on healthcare? Switzerland. I got ringers here. And what percent is that? 12. I'll help you, 11.5%. Now, an orthopedic surgeon can take his shoes off and use his fingers, and 18 minus 11.5 is 6.5% of GDP we spend in excess of Switzerland. Well, Switzerland covers everybody, okay? Any idea how big that number is? I'll tell you, staffers, the entire U.S. defense budget is only 3.5% of GDP. Twice the U.S. defense budget in excess of GDP is spent on health care, and we're not covering everybody. So we look at the challenge in Virginia to remain economically viable for our children and grandchildren as having to find the balance and figure out how we use this opportunity to reform the delivery and payment system. If we can't do this, this is unsustainable the day the sequester begins. Just point that out. Virginia has 8 million people, roughly, and some of them are pretty rough. We have about 970,000 in the Medicaid program. If you ask our governor, every time he mentions Medicaid, he can't help himself. He adds the fastest-growing program in the state budget since its inception. It now is 21% of our budget. What legislators at the state level don't understand is it's not just federal requirements, but we do some of this to ourselves. For instance, of the 98% increase in our Medicaid costs in the last 10 years, fully 38% of those were options that we chose to do. Waivers for individuals with ID and DD. So someone who's trying to be honest about it has to say, yes, but you do have to realize it's not just across the river that's making you do these things. So a challenge of reform in the state is not just getting the feds to do things differently, but getting your legislators to stand up to constituent groups and say, you know, we have to do things differently. It's a real challenge. We see and are concerned by the cost shifting in the Medicaid program. Many of you saw the map last of the country last year that showed that some of the states with the highest levels of coverage also do the most cost shifting, pay the providers the least. We believe that we're cost shifting, hospital cost shifting is probably 35 to 38% to the private sector. Now, it's better than having people who are uninsured under EMTALA being seen by hospitals and 100% is cost shifting. We've taken the view that there is this cost shifting, that we need to do Medicaid reform and innovation, and then as we save, in our projections for Virginia at a 68% take-up rate for Medicaid, we would probably in the first 5 years save $500 million for the Virginia budget versus baseline. Okay, the problem is that's only savings. The net 10-year cost to us is $137 million. Boy, that's great. It's only $137 million for Virginia to expand Medicaid at a 68% take-up rate. But that only happens if the legislature can keep their hands off of that $500 million in the first 5 years and put it towards the expenses in the out years. And we haven't seen much evidence of legislatures being able to do that. So that may be just a Virginia phenomenon, but we do worry a little bit about that. Now, we have done all the things that good Medicaid agencies and governments are trying to do. We're trying to become more effective and efficient. I have to remind the governor that Dr. Jindal, anybody from Louisiana here? If you're from Louisiana, you've heard you're doing the greatest Medicaid reform that ever happened. Virginia did most of that 17 years ago. We can't spend that. We can't get that savings again. We have been a managed care state for a long time. We are putting our foster kids in managed care, looking at waiver utilization rates, and you will hear in our state, all 30% is fraud. The Attorney General says that he's going to recover millions of dollars every year and return to the Medicaid program. Well, if I had a dollar for the promises, I'd have actually more than was returned in fraud recoveries. So we do have to look at getting away from the pay and chase to more data mining and not paying. So those are things that we have to look at. Behavioral health is a huge issue for us. It's always playing whack-a-mole. We solve a problem in one area and providers go to another area and our expenses go up. I will highlight the dual eligibles, the Medicaid, Medicare, a big, big issue. Barbara and CMS is working with us. Chuck has hit that. That's where the money is. Sutton's Law, if you're going to try to find cost savings, you got to go to the dual eligible problems. And the problems are the incentives aren't aligned. We believe in Virginia that to do some effective cost management and save both the state and the federal feds money, we would probably end up spending $50 million a year, and the savings would largely accrue to Medicare. Hard to sell that to our legislators, and so we are looking for the budget alignment, and I think we'll get there. I think that's on our agenda this year. So, and that's not a criticism of CMS. We're working well on solving that. So what the governor's looking for is really maximum flexibility for states under a comprehensive waiver. We will likely try to put in an 1115 waiver application and then consolidate all of our various waivers in that structure. Fairly simple from if it's just administrative, much more complicated if we start tinkering at the pieces that go in it. But so we are asking for a set of static parameters from the feds. We want to do innovation in the state. We don't believe what you can do in Northern Virginia is the same as what you can do way out in Wise County, which is west of Detroit. People don't realize Virginia is that big. We have these rural areas. So we want to be able to put it to negotiate pilots for innovation, but we'd like to have some parameters in place so when we go do it, we don't have to come back and double check. We want to put the rules in place and to basically say, yeah, as long as you stay in these parameters, you can try things on a pilot basis that are regional. We're looking to really looking at what we can do to the underlying, Title 19 underlying Medicaid statute regarding not so much cost sharing, because people don't have money, can't share costs, but can we look at networks, limited networks to high quality providers? Could we say, yes, maybe you do have to take a smoking cessation course, something along those lines that we are not able to do currently? We are number four, we're looking at setting up a metrics and an analytic unit in Medicaid. One of the challenges for states that have gone to managed care is that means we often are not as good at managing the care or even knowing what's happening as we were when we were doing fee-for-service. And as states have trimmed administrative budget, it's really kind of hard to know what is happening in the black box of a plan. So we're trying to figure out how to get that information back. And then we look at looking at stakeholder engagement long term. If we're going to do reforms, we got to keep the stakeholders at the table. If we just expand Medicaid, everybody gets what they want. How do we keep them there contributing? We won't go through the phases. That's not necessary at this point. But at some point, Ed, if we over time, but I could talk to you a little bit about what our innovation priorities are. They're listed here.
Great. And I'm sure we'll get a chance to get into that. As I mentioned, you now have a chance to ask the questions that our panelists didn't cover directly. You can either write it on a green card or go to the microphones that are situated on either side of the room. If you do that, we'd ask you to be as brief as you can in your question and to identify yourself. And if you hold the green cards up, someone will take it from you and bring it forward. Barbara, I've got a bunch of questions that either have come in advance or were highlighted by the presentation. Feel free to jump in. Let me start with one, just as a matter of clarification. Several of the speakers have talked about the 100% match, and Robin, you had that wonderful slide in your presentation. Would you just explain the difference between what's going on now in the Medicaid program with respect to the federal financing versus the state financing compared to this new increment that begins in January? Sure.
That's a good question. We covered that very briefly. But right now there is what's called the FMAP, or the federal matching percentage, that states, it's Medicaid's matching program. So states pay for services for eligible beneficiaries, and they receive a match back from the federal government. That match rate varies across the states in the country, and the poorer states, or states with lower per capita incomes, have a higher match rate that the federal government pays. So the match rate runs from a floor of 50%, so that means for every dollar that states spend, they get at least $1 back from the federal government, to a high of about just over 73% in Mississippi. What happens under the ACA is that for those who are made newly eligible by the law, the federal government will pay 100% of the costs of those who are newly eligible for the years 2014 through 2016. And then that share phases down to 90% by 2020 and then stays at 90%. So it's a much higher match rate than what states get for their regular Medicaid program. And that is why a lot of the costs, or the vast majority of the costs of the expansion, are really borne by the federal government.
Terrific. Dr. Hazel.
If I could, I'll give you some very specific examples. In Virginia, if we currently pay 100% for people in prisons and jails, if those individuals in the PPACA, when they are not in that facility overnight, if we expanded Medicaid, those people would be Medicaid eligible when they are not under the roof of the prison or the jail. 9 years, we think that'll save us $290 million because they become initially 100% federally funded and they work down to 90%. A lot of the mental health benefits that we pay for now with 100% state dollars, if our benefit package for Medicaid included these benefits, that gets us another $290 million. Indigent care fits in there, and so forth. So that's how it works on the front end. The difficulties we have is that as it tapers down, there are still increased costs for the expansion population that Virginia has. We are different, say, from anybody from Wisconsin here. Okay, your governor's brilliant. He's not going to expand Medicaid at all. He's going to add 165,000 insured, and he's going to transfer all the costs to the federal exchange. I mean, it's brilliant. We can't do that in the same way in Virginia because we aren't already insuring. We don't get the same benefits. But the point is, in the out years, we have to spend more. And I think across the country, most legislators are really wondering, particularly in light of what's happening in Congress, is the money really going to be there? I mean, for us, 1% is $40 million. Doesn't sound like much in Congress, but to a state budget, it is enormous. And so a couple percent change in the match rate over time destroys a state budget.
Can I just take this one step further? Because I keep hearing about people who are worried, state officials who are worried that while the expansion population is covered at 100% federal match, I guess it's not really a match if it's 100%, but if there are people who are now eligible, who, given all of the publicity around the expansion and the mandatory requirement that individuals have coverage, sign up for the coverage that they're eligible for now, you don't get 100%. How big a worry is this Woodwork effect that they talk about?
Can I, yeah.
Chuck?
So I'm going to answer that question. I want to sort of flag a couple of other dimensions of this cost issue. Our estimate in Maryland is we've got about 70% take up right now of people who are currently eligible for Medicaid but in the program. So about 30% of the people who could qualify today are not in the program based on our sort of data mining with census and other uninsured data. So we have built into a financial model that we've published, and it's out there for as a resource for anybody who's interested. The cost of adding take-up going up, which we do anticipate that there's, because of the simplified eligibility, the real-time adjudication that Barb mentioned and some other things, just advertising and all of that, that the take-up rate's going to go up, and that is a cost to the state that, by the way, also means insurance for the poor. There are a couple of other costs that I just tend to think get oversimplified in this conversation. And like, with all due respect to my friends in the federal government, the 100% match rate is true, but there are costs that I think, I mean, in Maryland, it's still a great deal, and we've got a lot of areas where we're going to save money because we're doing stuff with 100% state funding or that we'll be able to get part of this expansion. But I just want to put two on the table that I typically put on the table in these kinds of conversations that go beyond the Woodwork effect. The first is, administrative costs are not matched at 100%, even if a lot you're having to staff up to deal with a bigger program. So if we're spending more with utilization contractors, more employees, all of that, admin costs are still matched at the regular rate. And so if our infrastructure is going to grow, our costs are going to grow. The second one that rarely gets mentioned is, if in fact we need to raise provider rates to build out enough provider capacity to go in Maryland from 1 million people on Medicaid to 1.2 million people on Medicaid, and you know, specialists and surgeons and all of those providers are going to be seeing more people in their offices, they're going to want Medicaid to be a fairer payer and to not sort of pay at a discount. And so the pressure, and historically when the CHIP program came up in 97 in a lot of states, when states saw big expansions in earlier eras of Medicaid, there's pressure on provider rates because it's a greater percentage of the provider's mix in the office. And if you're raising your rates for a physician, you're not going to only raise them for those people serving the expansion. So if you're raising your rate from $45 a visit to $48 a visit, that's going to cut across your whole program and the regular match rate too. Now, in sum, all of that's in our financial model. In sum, it is financially in Maryland's interest to do this, even apart from the health policy and equity and, you know, good governance parts of it. But I do think that when you hear it's 100% fairly matched, why would any state not do it, it oversimplifies the rest of the costs associated with this.
Dr. Hayes, you want to add to that?
Yeah. To build on what Chuck has just told you, this is really important. The administrative costs are not inconsequential. We have too done the modeling just like them. We are using a 68% take-up rate for Medicaid in our projections. So when you read in the paper, Virginia will spend $137 million over baseline in between now and 2022 if Medicaid's expanded. That's at a 68% take-up rate and at current Medicaid rates. That also means that you've saved every dime versus baseline in those early years when we're saving those behavioral health things I just mentioned, the prisoner, all that has to be saved to get to that 137. Now, If we had 100% take-up, that number moves over $900 million for Virginia. That's the difference there. If we paid hospitals cost instead of 62% of cost, adds $2 more billion. So now we've gone, you know, really $3 billion. And if we brought physicians to Medicare rates, adds another billion. So it goes from being $137 million to $4 billion, depending on the assumptions that one makes. That would be a new state expenditure. And understand, our budget annually is only $45 billion, okay, less than that. So that's like a 10% budget increase right there, just on those assumptions. And those are things we operate with the best assumptions we can, but those are very, very real problems for state budget folks to try to deal with.
Okay. Yes.
Hi, I'm Joe Caldwell with the National Council on Aging, and we're really excited about some of the options that Barb mentioned for states to transform their long-term care systems to provide more services at home in the community instead of in institutions and nursing homes. And I would really acknowledge Chuck in Maryland. They were one of the first states that took advantage of some of those new options. And I guess my question is, we are sort of surprised that more states haven't taken advantage of those options. And so I guess my question is, you know, as states are thinking about bigger things like, you know, the Medicaid expansion, how can we make sure that long-term care doesn't get forgotten about and is included in that bigger vision? For either Chuck or Bill, from a state perspective, I guess.
From a state perspective, in our budget language last week, long-term care is stage three. We need to figure out how to make long-term care a higher value. That would generally mean more community alternatives, better care coordination, particularly out of the community, working with nursing homes to eliminate the bounce backs for admissions, things like that. The challenge that a Medicaid agency has, like in Virginia, people think of it as being this huge program. It'll be $8 billion in 2014. It's run by 350 people and a staff of contractors. And so when states have come through the budget cuts of the last few years, it leaves us with very, very little bench strength internally. And frankly, a lot of the work that we've done in Virginia, very good work, and I think has been done with the help of RWJ. I don't know if anybody's here from RWJ, but if you are, thank you, because we depend on them to help us through the thinking processes and the analytics and so forth. Going to a state legislature when you have a choice between adding, no state legislator wants to say, I added bureaucracy. Okay, they just don't want to do that. And so when I've got five people and they can be working on a dual eligible project or a long-term care project, they're going to work on the dual eligible project right now until we get that done. I just don't have the people for it.
Robin, you want to add to that?
Just one other thing. I think we are seeing, we do a budget survey with the states each year. We put it out in the fall, and we try to take a look at across a lot of different policy areas. And there are more and more states at least thinking about that, because we look at what they're going to do in the next fiscal year and what they're adopting in their state budgets. But what we also have seen is a continued effort and move in moving long-term care delivery from institutions to community-based settings. So even without taking up some of the new options, states have really, for a long time, been making those moves and continue to do so, even in light of a lot of other cost-cutting measures. That's an activity that goes along with some of these delivery system changes that states have been continually moving forward with.
And I do want to comment. I'll be really quick. Thank you for the compliment about Maryland. There are some great options in the ACA, and I want to thank those of you who helped kind of work on that legislation. The balancing incentive payment program is one. The community first choice option is one. Some of the important changes to money follows the person. Some of the important changes to some other parts of this in the new health home, Section 2703 options. To echo Bill's point, states have come through a really bad recession where states have had to balance budgets, and a lot of states just have resource challenges right now, given everything else, and their states are prioritizing, and different states have to prioritize in different ways. But I do want to give a shout out to Barb at the end of the table, because she's been great, and her staff has been great, which is spearheading a lot of these efforts. And it does help a lot that Barb comes from a state Medicaid director background and really knows how the rubber hits the road.
I think that's a cue.
Thank you. I'll say thank you very much. Known Chuck a long time, so he has to be nice. I want to just say for people to know, because I think you'll be interested, we have 9 states that now have a balancing incentive program grant approved, and that is where there's a wonderful opportunity to get enhanced federal matching dollars across all of their community-based spending that they can then reinvest in transformation of those systems. We have 4 more states that have an active application under review. And I think what I would say is that given the bandwidth issues that states have, and it's been very real, we're actually really thrilled at the level of response we're seeing from states. We have 46 states with Money Follows the Person now, so it's almost national in its breadth. And what we are really trying to do is to help states figure out how to use these different programs and leverage them together. So Connecticut was a good example of it, using Money Follows the Person resources to be able to support their balancing incentive program planning. We're really committed to doing that to help states figure out how to take advantage of the resources that are there. And trust me, the amount of money that states are spending on long-term care, it is not going to get ignored.
It's not. Yes, sir.
Hi, Derek Brandt with the American Academy of Neurology. And I was happy to see, Charles, you pointed out the fact of providing increased E&M rates to specialists within Maryland. And for us, it's a big issue because in the ACA, they actually outlined who specifically could qualify for increased E&M rates at Medicare rates. And they specifically listed internal medicine, family medicine, geriatrics, pediatrics, and internal medicine subspecialists were also qualified by CMS when they written the final rule. For us, it's a big issue because neurology does about 60% or more on average in their practices E&M care, but we're not able to qualify because we're boarded under a separate board of psychiatry and neurology. And so going forward, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on having specialists that are primarily cognitive focused like neurology, psychiatry, OBGYNs that aren't doing a lot of procedures into provisions like this in the future.
I can't.
Go ahead.
All right. For my physician friends, coming from the board of the AMA, a couple things need to be understood, and I think right now, you know, and when Chuck talks about the workforce problem, in sending more people to do workforce in Maryland, probably is taking it from someplace else. We're not actually increasing capacity very quickly in healthcare. That's a problem. We in Virginia, we believe at current levels we're challenged in primary care, particularly in behavioral health. Neurology is one of them, those whole things. But the idea that we can continue to perpetuate the current fee-for-service system is probably flawed. And so asking for higher E&M, higher this under fee-for-service and pay-for-volume is probably not a realistic long-term solution. What we're looking at in innovation and using some of the governor has given us some innovation money to work with, and the General Assembly is trying to take it away, but that's another problem. But we, in order to apply for the federal innovation, what we're looking for is how do you create a medical home model around a chronic disease situation? And if the primary problem is dementia or a neurologic disease, why are the physicians not looking about coming to us with models of how we can extend our capacity and give us what we want, which isn't somebody in the office doing a consult when it's convenient for them, but 24/7 coverage, access to records, regular checkups, less imaging, and things like that. And I think that my challenge for my profession, which I've spoken out for very strongly over the years, is that the game's up. And the old system isn't working, so I guess I'm going to push back a little. I don't think asking us to fix E&M codes is solving anybody's problem today, and I think we got to get past that. And the sooner Medicare gets rid of it and gets rid of that that elasticity that takes us back into all payment levels, just plain doesn't work. Nobody in primary care believes it. Orthopedist, which I am, is my practice was 50%+ E&M. Okay, didn't help me.
I agree with what Bill's saying. I mean, we really need to change the model of payment to more of a bundled rates and performance-based. And in Maryland, we are working on a variety of all-payer patient-centered medical home models. there's a lot of other dimensions to this that are longer term issues about training programs, how the GME, what does GME buy, people practicing at the top of the scope of their license, how to use more care coordination and paraprofessionals. All of those are dimensions to this issue, how to use electronic health records, how to use telemedicine. This is a multifaceted problem, and so I do concur with what Bill said.
Thank you.
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, hi. My name is Suri Kenny. I'm an independent consultant.
You might want to get closer to the microphone.
Can you hear now? This question is for Chuck and Bill. We heard earlier Barbara mentioned that if you have seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program. And Chuck, you said that the ACA actually is creating an environment where the rules are the same across the states, which, if I understood you correctly, it could be a hopeful thing that one day we will have a better system across the board. So my question is there a mechanism in place today that would enable states to work together on common objectives? For example, as Bill, you said, to set priorities, innovation priorities, or to define a innovation pilot that would support multiple states.
You want to clarify what is uniform?
Sure, yeah. That
uniform is pretty small.
Yeah, that's I'm being coached. and it's good coaching, by the way. For the eligibility part that's in the ACA, a lot of the eligibility changes is standardizing for parts, a large part of the Medicaid population, the eligibility determination rules. But what is not getting standardized is a lot of the other sort of dimensions of delivery system issues, how states are working with their local environments, rural and urban, their local provider networks and delivery systems and other kinds of initiatives. What is not getting standardized is benefit packages across states. What's not getting standardized is a lot of other interventions states are doing in a variety of different ways. There are mechanisms by which states are aligning and collaborating. There's various kinds of purchasing arrangements where states are working together. There's ways of sharing technology and sharing different innovative approaches. States are exploring that more and more, but it remains true that Maryland's the second state where I've run a Medicaid program. I ran the Medicaid program in New Mexico in the late 90s. Completely different state, completely different demographics, geography, challenges of how rural it is, dealing with 22 tribal governments. The variation and variability at the state level is real. So there are opportunities for collaboration. It tends to be more at kind of administrative and purchasing kinds of collaborations and less dealing with the variability of healthcare, because at its core, healthcare is delivered locally still. And I'll maybe sort of stop there.
I would echo that. As I said earlier, what you can do in Fairfax is different than what you can do in Wise, Virginia, or Hampton Roads, or any place else. And if I can't make it uniform in a state like Virginia, I don't think you can make it uniform in the U.S., particularly when we don't have a model that actually is that dramatically superior right now. So what I think the advantage of the PPACA, or at least this Medicaid program, is that it's allowing more innovation in the states and perhaps in some ways variability. Now, that is balanced by the fact that those of us who are sort of the worker bees in this thing talk regularly. I mean, you got Matt Salo over here from National Association of Medicaid Directors, and they have meetings, it seems like, all the time, and it's almost like there's too many meetings that we aren't getting work done, not because just of you, but everybody wants to have a meeting to discuss X, so there's a lot of cross-fertilization. But if I could go back to that eligibility problem, congressional staff, MAGI, people call it MAGI, we call it MAGI because we're not sure it's Wise yet. The problem is that Medicaid isn't the only program these people sign up for. And an individual doesn't come to us to get health insurance, they come for help. And sometimes they need SNAP benefits, and sometimes they need TANF benefits, and sometimes they need WIC benefits, and sometimes these other things. And the problem is none of those eligibility systems really are consistent and the standards are not consistent. So fixing MAJ actually right now is just, particularly the simplified form, is just giving our people more work to do, unfortunately.
Barb, you want to add anything to that? Okay.
I have no wisdom to add to that.
I'm sorry. LeVar Poindexter with Men's Health Network. Is there any kind of an initiative to get new enrollees into Medicaid that might have underlying unknown health concerns that, you know, they might not have had access to given that they haven't had health care in the past, like a system like Welcome to Medicaid or something similar? Say someone goes to the emergency room, is there any way to get them a screening before they enroll in the program to identify something to kind of keep from some of the costs from piling up later down the line after not identifying those problems?
You're talking about eligibility screening or medical screening?
Medical screenings, in terms of, you know, making sure that we don't let things go by without seeing what problems people have before enrolling into the program.
I will describe what happens in Maryland and not sort of adhering to the one program rule. What happens when somebody signs up is we have a vendor that we refer to as an enrollment broker. For those people who are enrolled in a managed care organization, it's the vast majority of Medicaid populations in Maryland. Our managed care program excludes dual eligibles, excludes people with long-term care needs. But for virtually everybody else statewide, it's managed care. What happens is the enrollment broker conducts what we refer to as a health risk assessment. So they ask about medication somebody's on. They ask about chronic illness. They ask about whether a woman's pregnant. They do a screen, and that's a health risk assessment. And then they ask the person to choose a managed care organization based on provider networks, and they help counsel that person to choose an MCO. And about 75% of our eligibles choose affirmatively, and about 25% we end up then kind of auto-enrolling. For that group who go through that health risk assessment, the MCO who's receiving their new member gets with that this health risk assessment, and their case managers are expected to contact that person within 10 days to start making that transition happen. So it is part of that. We're also, if part of your question was getting at just kind of how you set rates, payment rates, based on acuity and risk adjustment, that's part of what we're doing as well.
Dr. Hazel.
I think, frankly, I mentioned earlier, the Title 19 does limit what you can require people to do who are in Medicaid. Some of it's around cost shifting. Some of it's around localization of programs, not statewideness, et cetera. But what we are looking at, I'd encourage you, we won't do it now, to look at the concepts of value-based insurance design and how you tie that to perhaps either requiring individuals condition of participation to actually have to do something themselves. We've spent a lot of time in the healthcare looking at the demands or at the supply side, how we control the providers and how we do this and how we do that. But at the end of the day, demand is part of the equation, and we really do have to look more at the beneficiaries and asking them on behalf of the taxpayers who are supporting them to actually do some things that make sense. It may not be money. It may be something, maybe limiting a network to a network you know that's going to deliver the goods better. So those are things we'd like to be able to toy with.
Okay. Well, let me go to the next questioner, but I should tell you that Barbara Lyons is sitting on about 127 green cards. So if you're absolutely committed to getting your question asked, you might want to jump to the top of the line by going to the microphone, as this person has already done.
All right. My name is Faye Gordon. I'm with the National Senior Citizens Law Center, and thank you for this panel. My question, Dr. Hazel, you mentioned that one of the challenges with managed care in your state is that you can't really tell what's happening on the ground sometime with the managed care organizations. It's not as clear as in fee-for-service. And I'm wondering, as Virginia moves forward with its dual eligible demonstration and states in general move to managed care for long-term services and supports, is there a move for an ombuds office or some office that can sort of help report to the state what's happening on the ground to sort of alleviate this challenge of not knowing?
I think we do have an ombudsman office aging and rehab services. So that those things exist in a lot of places. I can't speak for other states, but I know we have it. But it's not so much that. Those are generally there for problems. What I'm talking about is actually getting, you know, raw data. How are people doing? How much of what is done? Who's having complications? And an individual who goes with a particular problem to a is not, it may highlight and may be a tip of the iceberg that we need to investigate further. But what I was addressing is the more general analytics necessary to know whether the services you're providing are adding value or not.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Debbie Plotnick with Mental Health America. And Chuck mentioned that in Maryland they're looking to teach providers on the private side how to access insurance for behavioral health. And my question is about behavioral health and the lack of it on the private side and how that affects Medicaid. In my experience, it keeps people poor so they can access services in Medicaid. And I'm concerned as more people come in, again, this will be an incentive to keep people poor, and what states may be doing to help grow the behavioral health access on the private side, and also about prevention for young people in particular who may be already in Medicaid so that they don't end up disabled or poor, so they remain in the Medicaid system.
Is there somebody in particular you're aiming that question at?
At anyone who wants to touch it, is there anything going on at CMS? Is there anything going on in the states?
I can tell you what we're doing. We've got a fair amount going on, and one of the issues we have, I mentioned earlier the innovation. I didn't get to that last slide, but one of our innovation work groups is around the integration of mental and physical health. Number one, people who have mental health illnesses don't necessarily recognize them as mental health illnesses in the place they show up, maybe at a primary care physician or in medical treatment or, mm-hmm. frankly, in an orthopedic surgeon's office, seen plenty of it with something that is related due to pain management or whatever it is. And we just don't, you know, when we're programmed in our cycles of, well, I got to take care of the tennis elbow, not the behavior that's driving the problem, we don't deal with that. So we're looking and trying to figure out, can we do a better job of integrating mental and physical health, a little bit modeled after Community Care Networks North Carolina, okay. where they've hired psychiatrists to counsel the primary care physicians and to monitor how they're doing with the patients who have ICD-9s related to mental illness. So that's one of the things we're looking at to get capacity. Another area where we're trying to build capacity, we have tremendous gaps in psychiatry, psychology, social workers in our rural areas, and we have a fairly robust telehealth program. And interestingly, that seems to work pretty well for mental health. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. Another area where that comes into play is around crisis intervention. We've been training law enforcement and CITs, and what we're trying to do is when an individual is detained, divert them into mental health treatment as opposed to giving them criminal records. It's easier today for law enforcement to put somebody in jail than it is to get them treatment. So we are actively trying to address that by getting proper assessments. And telehealth in areas where you don't have resources is a part of that. We recognize limitations of resources, and that does follow funding, lacks of funding, but one of the advantages of a Medicaid expansion is more funding for mental health.
Barbara?
I'd just like to say we have a lot of activity going on around this area. With regard to your question on the private sector workforce, I don't have a lot to suggest about that except to say that as providers in the public system become more comfortable with how to do billing and be a part of that system, remember, mental health and substance use services are going to be a part of the essential health benefits that are offered through the exchange, as well as a service that's available in Medicaid, and that is, we think, going to go a long way toward giving buying power to people and be able to stay employed and not have to stay poor in order to mm-hmm. get these services. The issue of larger capacity is a shared problem that I think we all are thinking about and trying to find solutions to. Beyond that, we've been working very hard, including with the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, learning from them and the work that they've been doing in some of these areas about improved screening and how do you find better referrals and connections for primary care physicians who are encountering children in need. We are doing some work around trying to get better information into the hands of states so that as they are looking at improving their programs, that we are they're aware of all the resources that are out there about screening and about models of care. We have a partnership with the Administration for Children, Youth, and Families, with CMS and SAMHSA, looking at children in foster care in particular and better understanding the role of trauma that may be playing in the lives of those children and sometimes becomes a heavy behavioral health or mental health diagnosis when it might really be a trauma kind of related problem. So I think there's a lot of activity going on. We can talk more about it in other forums around these issues. And I think it's one of the areas, both as a former Medicaid director and as at the federal level, there's tremendous excitement and I think in growing recognition that it's one of the areas where there is the most room to improve. And by improving, we could perhaps make the most difference in terms of the cost of healthcare overall, as well as the health of our communities. So I think we feel at the federal level that we have to play a more deliberate and attentive role around the issue of good behavioral health care. And I think we're seeing a lot of interest and, in fact, a lot of leadership at the state level, particularly around the kids issue.
There's actually, I want to just sort of rattle off a few things very quickly. First, Maryland and many states are building out their notion of what a patient-centered medical home is and what services ought to be included. And we are certainly sort of integrating behavioral health in and also having behavioral health homes that are really where you're sort of putting the primary care into the behavioral health setting instead of the other way around. Second, with respect to a lot of states that have health information exchanges, you know, data hubs for sharing of electronic health records, we have one in Maryland. All 47 hospitals in the state are connected. When somebody hits the emergency room, while they're in the emergency room, a patient, an alert is sent to that person's primary care provider. If that primary care provider is connected, we've got now over 500 primary care providers connected to that system across payers. So they get an alert, your patient's at the hospital. We are folding in psychiatrists and other treating providers so that they get those alerts that say, your patient's here, maybe in crisis, you need to follow up. Third, a lot of the readmission payment reforms that are going on in Medicare, Medicaid, and other payers, people are doing the data mining, and what they're finding is that almost half of all readmissions to hospitals have an underlying behavioral health problem. Sometimes it's compliance with taking medications and adherence. Sometimes it's behavioral health conditions. And so hospitals that are getting penalized in terms of reimbursement for that readmission are now starting to work back out to the community providers and shore up their discharge planning on the initial discharge to do a better job with all of that. And the 17th thing I'll mention on my little list here is we are concerned on the commercial side about what our mental health community refers to as phantom networks, which is a commercial carrier will say, here's all of our mental health providers, but none of them are taking new patients, by the way. And so part of network adequacy is going to look into that. And with respect to the continuity of care I mentioned in the slides, one of the things is if somebody's coming over from Medicaid and they're stable on, you know, a psychotropic, for example, to not make them go back through step therapy all over again. So all of that's part of what we're working on as well.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just ask what part of what the questioner had in mind was what was going to happen when we get this new population signed up? And am I correct that there is expected to be a disproportionate occurrence of behavioral health problems in this new population because you're going to have all these homeless folks who couldn't sign up because there was no category before or other reasons? And if so, what do you do about that?
The short answer is yes. And what I say, it's going to be capacity building as much as anything. You have to have the benefit in the Medicaid plan, and you have to be adequate payment, and then you have to build the capacity because even if you're paying for it, if there's no one there to deliver it, and I can pay more than Chuck can, and then people move from Maryland to Virginia, and he's got the problem, it hadn't really helped. So I think it's going to be looking more at a team-based approach to mental health a little bit. How we use people. The top of the license language is tricky because at the top of my license, I can do thoracic surgery, but you probably don't want me to. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, remember. There is not a monopoly on ethics and caring necessarily in the licensed professions. It's about knowledge and how one works in the team. So I think that's how we're going to have to address it, at least early on, sort of deputize the folks who can help and be trained to help fill that role.
We are seeing a lot of interest in telemedicine. We're seeing a lot of interest on states to develop sort of organized networks where the rare professionals the can be available by phone or by internet to primary care treating professionals. There is creativity that can be done here, and we can do a better job with it. I would just like to underscore, we actually think it's a terrific problem to have. Yeah. Because it means we're finally getting coverage extended for some very important services.
And I'd pray if my commissioner was here, he'd slap me, but I didn't mention peer support and peer networks. Because we're out visiting in San Diego in December around military and veterans issues, and the biggest leading cause of death in the military is suicide, and with the discharges that are coming out, we'll see more. We have a high population of veterans in Virginia, and we are concerned about that, so we're looking at the setting up the 211 line, courage to call, and perhaps actually if a person identifies as having served, then they get to another person who has served, so you've got a peer contact network, because it's not just, we have some money in the budget for suicide prevention. Another piece is mental health first aid, as we will be addressing. And the trick is once you've identified an issue, who do you call? And Ghostbusters doesn't help you with that, so we're trying to create that network.
Yes, sir, you've been very patient.
Oh, it's fine. I'm Ethan Jorgensen-Arp. I'm with the National Association of Public Hospitals. You were talking before about maybe instituting capitation or some sort of system like that. In my field, risk adjustment comes up quite a bit. It's a sensitive topic for our member hospitals for various reasons, but I didn't know if you had heard of any system being employed that, started a risk adjustment system within capitation, or whether it was just going to be general capitation right now.
I'll say just generally that in fact, it's pretty common that capitation payments to health plans from states are developed in ways that reflect the relative risks of the different individuals who are being insured through that mechanism. And in fact, in many places, the way the health plans in turn contract and do business with the providers in their systems is fee-for-service. That fee-for-service might be a DRG payment to a hospital, it might be a per diem, it might be a service fee. There are, of course, some subcapitation arrangements within those plans, but I don't think that's the predominant way in which folks do business. I think as folks are looking at accountable care organizations, at other kinds of models, you're seeing more of an interest in this idea of, if not fully capitating a provider network or an accountable care organization, at least having more of an episode of care or a larger responsibility so you're not buying transactions, but you're trying to get toward that issue of buying the outcomes that folks want, which include efficiency, quality, and good value. I don't know if Chuck or Dr. Hazel have specific state examples, but...
No, I think your point is well taken, and sort of tie back to the last question. In Maryland, we've actually expanded to some childless adults, the future ACA expansion population. We expanded early for a limited benefit, so there's no inpatient benefit, but we provide outpatient specialty behavioral health and primary care and some things. So we've got about 80,000 people in our program right now who will roll into the full benefit expansion. These are childless adults below 116% of poverty in Maryland. Many of them have behavioral health issues. Many of them have addiction. And we're going to be using a risk adjustment strategy that involves the medications that they're prescribed as an indicator of their diagnoses, because there are some pharmacy groupers as a risk adjustment tool that say, okay, if you're on this set of medications, you're likely at this kind of acuity and this complexity. It's not a perfect instrument, but it's an instrument we're going to be using to pay that expansion population because we have some data now. With respect to your providers in your association, I think that ACO models and bundle payment models that involve hospitals do need to reflect the fact that public hospitals tend to see a sicker population. They tend to see a safety net population. There is a lot of segmentation in the hospital market, and for-profit hospitals tend to skim and other things like that. So to the extent you're taking downstream risk, there has to be a good risk adjustment model, and there are some tools out there for that.
Okay, Barbara has a number of questions. I would just ask you, as we take these last few minutes, to deal with some of those questions, that you pull out the blue evaluation form and fill it out as you listen to the Q&A. Barbara?
Thanks, Ed. We have a couple of questions around coordination with the exchange and how the federal hub will work, and will everything be up and ready to go in October, and what are the issues that folks see, if anybody wants to comment on some of that.
I'd like to hear that answer from CMS.
Yes, no kidding. If my colleagues from SOCIO were here, they could do that.
I think if, Barb, I can just say in Virginia, we obviously are not building an exchange. The General Assembly has decided that we can do plan management for the exchange, and I think we'll be ready to do that. We are building the eligibility system as well. We rolled out a customer-facing portal for our social services last year, and we have we're well underway in replacing our eligibility and enrollment system. The current one is built on, I think, vintage 1991 technology and costs $17 million a year just to maintain, and we are upgrading that with 90-10 money that CMS has provided. We believe that if all goes well, and frankly, it's going to involve getting some information we don't have. We are at the point where we're having to make assumptions about what we'll have to do because we haven't gotten complete guidance. I suspect Chuck's got a little bit of that going on, too. And not being critical, it's a huge lift in a very, very short time period. But if everything goes well, we will be able to do the MAGIC determinations for this. And what we have asked, and we have gotten some funding to do, is from the exchange funds, is to create a data layer so that we can transmit information electronically to the if individuals should come to us, they're not going to know whether they're Medicaid or exchange eligible. And what we'd like to be able to do is just to have those things screened and sent electronically to the federal exchange, so we become a port of access as well. We think it's better customer service. So we're working to try to get that accomplished as well.
Is there a cutoff date for states to decide whether or not to expand?
No.
But you do, if you don't start on January 1st, the 100% federal funding begins January 1st, and it's for 3 years. If you come in 6 months late, you lose 6 months of that and continue on.
I think it is worth mentioning this has been an area where there's been a lot of sort of activity from the National Governors Association asking whether they could expand partway and not all the way up to 70% of poverty or 100% of poverty. And HHS has read the ACA legally to say it's all the way or not at all. So I think that will be an area where there will be continued ongoing lobbying from the NGA. Maryland is going all the way with that, but that's a sort of a secondary issue about kind of incrementally expanding.
Another question that has come up relates to the...
Might get to the microphone a little closer.
Is there any talk of switching FMAP from per capita income to something that more accurately reflects the state's total available resources to treat low-income populations? That's an issue that comes up periodically.
Have to ask a Washington person that. I haven't heard about it, but Virginia is a 50% match rate state, so we would like to get more.
And therein lies the interesting dilemma of any of those conversations. How do you have everybody get more?
Yeah. No fight like a formula fight.
And I'm going to take one more question because we're getting really close to 2 o'clock here, but we'll circle back to long-term care once. What do you mean when you talk about community-based long-term care? Does that mean an assisted living facility? Does it mean living in the community with family members? What are the options there?
It could be any of those. In some ways, we take some direction from the Americans with Disabilities Act that says that individuals with living with disabilities have a civil right to receive public services in the most integrated community setting, and that it's in fact a violation of civil rights in this country to require someone to be institutionalized in order to receive services that are appropriate and can be delivered in a setting of their choice. So when we think about home and community-based settings, we are, and as states have been working for years to create a broader array of options for individuals who need long-term services and supports, and where Medicaid is the principal third-party buyer of those services. Families and individuals provide a lot of those services unpaid as well. We are looking at the full array, and obviously that starts with an individual's own home, and it might also include choices people make in their own home might be an assisted living setting. What we have been working on at the federal level and with states in dialogue is, and through some proposed regulations, is beginning to define what the characteristics of a home and community-based setting are and what it means to be home and community-based. And I guess the thing that, and it's been a fascinating conversation worth a whole other panel, but I think what we are looking for is sort of what is the individual's experience and what's their level of autonomy and ability to control their own lives, and that's really what we're all working to support for individuals. It also, in many cases, can cost less money.
Two very good observations with which we can close this discussion. Thanks to you for enduring not only the first day of the sequester and the vagaries of the temperature of this room, but also for asking some really good questions, some of which we actually got to ask. I think the conversation really reflects the fact that maybe this was the toughest 101 we're going to do, because here you have Medicaid itself evolving into a much more prominent component in the healthcare coverage fabric in the United States, and you've heard a lot of that woven into the answers that our panel, which was not stumped, was giving to the questions that you've asked. Thanks for the questions. Thanks for filling out the evaluation form. Ask you to join me in thanking our panel for what was a very enlightening discussion of a very complicated subject.